everyone, to another episode of Mention and Dispatches. I joked before about not necessarily knowing what number we were on, and really that's not a joke this time. Just because of scheduling, we are actually recording these out of order. And so my guest tonight is Andrew Buchholz, sports writer, music aficionado, and most importantly, wargamer. And that is why he is joining us tonight. So howdy, Andrew.
Howdy, Brant. Thanks a lot for having me.
Oh, no, this is awesome. Appreciate you working around the scheduling to be able to join us. And so as we are recording this, like, they've just announced the NCAA tournament picks and seedings and everything. And so by the time this gets released, we're going to be like four rounds into the tournament. So we could make some picks and just be horribly wrong for everyone to laugh by the time we get there. But we'll probably spare the audience that one.
For sure.
Real quick, we are going to do a little bit of business up front just because we've been doing this at the back end of the podcast. We're going to pull them to the front here. And our Patreon supporters, we've got a handful of really awesome Patreon supporters, and a couple of them are supporting us at a level at which we have threatened to acknowledge them by name on the podcast. And so Joseph Knoll, Treb Curry, Kevin Bertram, and Patrick Garrity, several of those guys have been with us since we opened the Patreon. Those folks are supporters at a higher level. And so we want to make sure we acknowledge those guys here on the podcast. And so Joseph, Treb, Kevin, and Patrick, thank you very much for your support of the Dragoons and helping keep us on the air here. All right. Business handled. Andrew, you and I started interacting initially on Twitter. I'm the guy who primarily runs the Armchair Dragoons Twitter feed, but it's not like my personal feed. So I try to be a little careful about what's said on there because there are other members of the Dragoons team that have access to it. But I think we first started interacting around some of the wargaming stuff, but then also when Eddie Van Halen died and you were talking Van Halen tunes. And so I kind of chimed in. I was like, hey, wait a minute. What about these other songs? In terms of your music fandom, some of the things I've seen you talk about is a little all over the map. Give us a little synopsis of sort of some of your favorites, kind of triangulate some of what you really dig and how you turned into being a music fan like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think all over the map's a pretty good description of where I stand musically. So I grew up playing the drums, actually. I did that for about 10 years pretty seriously. And so one thing that's always interested me is bands of a great drummer. That's why Rush is one of my favorite bands for Neil Peart, who's just an absolute legend there. But I like a lot of different classic rock stuff. Van Halen always stood out to me just because probably the best way to describe my musical taste is that I like musicians performing at a really high level. And I think Eddie Van Halen did that a lot, managed to come up with just some incredibly innovative guitar riffs. Yep. I'm all over the map. Beyond the classic rock, I like a lot of 70s and 80s heavy metal, especially British stuff like Judas Priest and Iron Maiden. Iron Maiden fits in well here too, because one thing that really appeals to them about me is their songs about history and about various battles or even various epic poems and so on. And so that sort of thematic tie-in goes a long way for me as well. But then at the other end of the spectrum, I'll listen to a lot of 90s and 2000s pop punk. So it's pretty wide ranging. It's pretty whatever I'm in the mood for on a given day.
I grew up an 80s metalhead, and I was living in Europe for much of the 80s. So I had access to a little more off the beaten path than just the 80s LA hair metal that was kind of dominating the US. And so that gave me some extra insights to some stuff that folks here in the States had never even really heard of. I remember when Dora Opesh first released some of her solo stuff that started to get some airplay here in the US. And my friends are like, hey, isn't this really cool? And I pull out my Hellbound album from 1994 and go, I've had it for 5 years. Because I remember them from when I was living over in Europe. And look, I'm not going to lie. Like, I bought the album because Dora was hot. You know, I was like, you know, hey, I gotta hear this girl. And then it turns out she can sing too. And so that's kind of cool. And so that's, you know, my 80s metalhead tastes still come through quite frequently. And I get teased for it a bit over at the forums with the Dragoons. But then in the 90s, I spent a couple of years living out in Monterey, California. And I think it's really hard to live out in Monterey and not absorb some of the contemporary jazz lifestyle that they have out there.
And, sure. Yeah.
And so It's always kind of funny when I end up being the guy in charge of the music at whatever large gathering we're at. So it's been at least a year. I'll start cranking up some hard rock something or some 80s power pop or something that if people ever start getting annoyed by, I'm like, damn it, this is crap. Turns out, all right, here comes Candy Dulfer, right? Here comes Mindy Abair. Here comes Keiko Matsui. You know, we're going to put on the smooth jazz and let's see how long before you start complaining to put something hip that usually wins. I played guitar badly for many years. So when you talk about, you know, looking for the drummers, I tend to try to find some of the better, more understated or off the beaten path guitar work.
For sure. Yeah.
That's something that I like listening to. There's folks that follow our Tuesday Newsday column that we run each week on Tuesday, if you can believe it. We close out each one of those with the links back to 6 Degrees of Radio, which is the music site that I had set up that was an outgrowth of a radio show that I used to do here in town. The radio show just kind of ended up being a real pain in the butt for the program director to put together just with the digital interface he had to build the show with. So I ended up taking the whole thing offline and just doing everything through this blog with YouTube links to all the songs, but lots of commentary on the songs. And so I ended up talking a bunch about the different guitar work and the layering and the production where I find some really cool stuff in there. But I do give some shout outs to some drum work as well. The guys from the Revivalists with the song Criminal in particular, very tight rhythm section on that tune. Had to highlight that one. And then there was an Australian band in the mid 90s. You might have heard of them as, you know, sort of a rock punk kind of hybrid. There was the Screaming Jets. They had two albums that came out in the mid 90s. The first one is fantastic and the second one is crap.
Fair enough, yeah.
As often happens, right?
Yeah,
you get a great first album, the second album, you're like, what the hell happened to these guys? But there was a song on there called Better, and it's not a fantastic song, right? It's not going to set the world on fire. But what it is, it's a perfect masterclass in showing a drummer what the drummer's supposed to do in the song, right? Here's keeping the time. Here's where you use the fill to signal that there's a change in what's about to happen. And here's where you change, you know, the next fill indicates that you're going to the, you know, this kind of fill takes you to the chorus. This kind of fill takes you back to the verse. And it's just for somebody just learning to play drums, that's like, this is your job. But the drums in the mix are so good at it. That's the whole thing, the way it's mixed. It really gives you a good sense of it. So.
Oh, that's cool. I'll have to check that one out. Yeah.
It's you, even if you hadn't picked up drumsticks in 10 years, you could probably still play it without a problem.
Sure.
It's not a challenging song. It's just sort of a good basic instruction there.
So. I always appreciate, like, there's obviously there's value in the crazy stuff and the really hard stuff, but I always appreciate good simplicity, well executed, right? One of the ones that stands out there to me is AC/DC, and they've had different drummers over the years, but all of their drummers just provide very simple, very competent beats that don't get in the way, and they let Angus Young do whatever crazy guitar stuff he's doing over the top of it.
Yep. There have definitely been some people that I think are underappreciated as drummers simply because they met the appropriate standard for their band, which is don't screw up.
Right. Exactly.
Given how many bands you can find where the drummer screwed up or the guitar player, whoever, like somebody just, you could have gone simple and just got it right. You reached and exceeded and shouldn't have. Sometimes it's nice to just keep it simple and not screw it up. So.
For sure.
That was always my theory whenever I was – look, I was a rhythm guitarist and a bad one. And so my primary, you know, my primary success criteria was don't screw up. And,
right. Absolutely.
So there's a reason I don't play live much anymore. I'm sure we've now lost half the audience talking about music for 5 or 10 minutes. Talk to me a bit about some of your gaming background, sort of. I know you're more of a gaming omnivore and not just a wargamer, but you did join us for the January AC/DC and you were at SDHISCon and you've done a variety of wargaming events also. How'd you get to where you are now with your gaming?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, board games have long been a thing for me, growing up with my parents and my uncle, who is quite into games. And The first one I really remember getting started with was Silverton, which is this really old, very good train game, originally from Two Wolf, and then it came up from Mayfair a little later. And so I think that introduction to the hobby, or to at least the more advanced side of the hobby, really helped send me down a path where I was interested in historical games, whether that's train games. I play a lot of train games, but I also I like a lot of war games. And for what they can tell you about history and what they can tell you about the different goals of whoever was involved in a particular battle or in a particular series of events. War games, I think, have become a bigger thing for me probably the last decade, and I think some of that is I started discovering some of GMT's titles, and some of them fit very well with the sort of things I like. I like a lot of the coin games, Liberty or Death in particular, for just the way it really gets. I think that series in general really it does a good job of getting you into the minds of those participants and their particular goals, and Liberty or Death is interesting because it's one where you have these seeming allies in the French and the Americans on one side and in the British and the natives on the other side, but they're all out for their own goals. And I think that, which is something that's explored in a lot of the Koi games, is a very good way to look at history in terms of not everyone was purely 100% in step at all times. My university degree is in history, so it's a bachelor's from Queen's University up in Canada, and so exploring it academically got me more interested in not just books on history, but also games on history. And so that's got me into things like the coin series. I really like a lot of card-driven games. One of my favorites is For the People, Mark Herman's American Civil War game. And the American Civil War has always been a big focus for me in my reading. So it's cool to see how many great games there are out there on that front. And then I also enjoy games on some more interesting topics that aren't as widely covered, because I think those are a really excellent way to sort of get into that. You mentioned the AC/DC convention you guys ran, and one of the things I really enjoyed doing there was playing by Stealth and Sea, David Thompson's co-design, and about Italian frogmen and their attempts to blow up British Navy ships. And I'd never really heard of that topic or explored it before that, but the game was a really good introduction into it, and it put it on my radar as something to read more about.
Yeah, I think David Thompson is trying to corner the market in games about battles no one's ever heard of.
Right. Yeah. No, he's got a lot of interesting ones.
I remember reading about Castle Itter just as one of those, you know, here's this wacky story from World War II, you know, back when I was, you know, a youngster, just sort of reading random history magazines, you know, the strangest battle of World War II, sort of back when it was clickbait on the magazine rack.
Right. Yeah.
And so I had remembered reading something about Castle Itter, but like, you know, soldiers in postman's uniforms, you know, the defense of the post office. And it's like, where the hell are you finding these things? Like, it's cool. It's a really neat topic. The, you know, by Stealth and Sea, it's a really neat topic. Where the hell are you coming up with this? But I think you're right. I think there's definitely some value in some where the hell did this come from kind of battles out there. Those are always interesting. I'm always astounded at Jim Ozarski's ability to pull up some Napoleonic battle nobody has ever heard of.
And sure.
Like, oh yeah, but there's like these five scenarios for these eight different minis games out there that you could. Jim, where do you find this stuff? Something that I thought was interesting, this just occurred to me tonight, where, again, you know, sort of your professional background, you're a sports writer, but a couple of years ago, I had the good fortune, I interviewed Christina Carl on another podcast many moons ago. We managed to catch her. There was like a two-day window in which we could have caught her for this podcast, where she was coming off of her honeymoon and about to head to baseball spring training. And so we managed to find like the only 2-day window in there in which we could have tried to schedule a podcast with her and managed to catch her. And one of the things I asked her about was, you know, hey, in the sports world there with you, are there many other wargamers? Do you run into many at all? And really, like, Kurt Schilling was the only one anybody could think of. And you know, it's not like he's a secret that he's a wargamer.
Right.
Leave leaving aside anything else about Curt Schilling, dude's a war gamer, and the dude yes. has been the money behind MMP for a lot of years, and that's awesome. Like, he's kept ASL around for a long time, and that's great. And she was, you know, sort of like, I really don't know of any others. And so, you know, to mathematically, there had to be at least one other sports writer out there who, you know, sure. a war gamer somewhere. And I guess maybe y'all just hadn't crossed paths at that point in time, or, you know, whatever. But it was cool to find another one of you that's, you know, into wargaming.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I don't know about how in wargaming specifically, but there are a lot of people in the sports world who are getting quite into board games in general. And I think on the baseball front, I think one that's always very cool is Keith Law, the very famous baseball writer who now works for The Athletic after a long career at ESPN. Yep. And he's super into board games and mostly Euro games, but he writes lots of reviews of them for Pace Magazine and so on. And I always think that's interesting, seeing somebody from both of my sort of spheres of influence there.
Yeah, I've been reading Keith Law's stuff for a long time, and he's one of the guys who was one of the reasons I signed up for The Athletic originally. Mm-hmm. I only have like two, maybe three paid subscriptions online. The Athletic is one of them, and I, you know, I'm going to sound like a shill for him. I think it's some of the best money I've spent on sports writing in a long time, in part because a couple of the people I really like and have followed for years are now there. Mm-hmm. Keith was one of them. Richard Deitch and Sean McIndoe mm-hmm. are two of the others. And
yeah, they're both excellent, for sure.
Yeah, and so having those guys there. I didn't realize Keith wrote reviews of war games, though. I don't know that, or not war games, but board games. I don't know that mm-hmm. that had ever crossed my radar there. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, he started doing it just on his own blog, and then I think the last couple of years or so, he's been doing them for that Pace Magazine site. So yeah, it's pretty cool, and he always gets mentioned in the various roundups of like the best 10 games or whatever. So it's always interesting to see him be prominent on that front.
That's pretty cool. I remember reading an article somewhere, like one of the ways in which the Green Bay Packers bond, like mm-hmm. the offensive linemen, they bond over Settlers of Catan.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that one made a big splash a couple of years ago when they were writing about that.
I'm going to be the unpopular dude and fart in church and just say, I'm not a big fan of the game. I just sure? don't like it. And this is, I'm a dude who's like a huge 4X gamer, and I there's something about it that just kind of rubs me wrong. I'm not 100% sure what it is.
I think that's totally fair. I mean, I think it, and especially for somebody like you who's already been in this hobby for so long and has played a lot more advanced things, I think it's pretty easy to look at Settlers and be like, there's nothing there that really impresses me. For me, it was sort of a mid gateway game. I started playing it with my family after we'd already played a bunch of other stuff, but it definitely was a prominent thing for us for several years. And I'm still happy to play it if somebody wants to. I think I'd agree with you that like there are other games that do a lot of that better, but I think that Settlers has played an important role. And I think where Settlers really plays an important role is especially with how prominent it became. It was a way to get people to move beyond like Monopoly and Clue, right? And
absolutely.
Like some of the people who have no idea about any of the rest of this hobby might try Settlers and then might see, okay, what else is like this?
Yes, absolutely. It has definitely served as a huge entry point into the hobby gaming world for a lot of people whose attention span was limited by what was on the shelf at Target. I think you're absolutely right there. And so a friend of mine once tried to sum it up, and I'm not going to say he's 100% accurate on my thoughts, but it's pretty close. And that is, Settlers seems to be too long for the relative simplicity of it. Mm-hmm. And not complex, not enough depth for how long it does take.
Sure.
And I think that's not a bad way to say, because like I love Seven Wonders. Seven Wonders is a great mm-hmm. game, and it plays fast. I mean, you spend more time sure. handing cards to each other than you do actually, you know, manipulating the board. And you get a lot of depth and some pretty fast gameplay out of Seven Wonders. And I almost feel like you get more depth out of that game than you do out of 2.5 hours of Settlers, you know? So
Yeah, I can see that for sure. I like Seven Wonders a lot. I think one thing that Seven Wonders does really well is it's a game that plays well at a higher player count because so much of it is simultaneous. And so
exactly.
with the groups I've played, play Eurogame stuff with, whether that's in person or online, it's always a good one when you've got five or six people and there aren't a lot of other ones that fit that space very well.
Yeah. Yeah, the going from five players to seven players in something like Warrior Knights or Twilight Imperium just added a half a day to the game.
Right, yeah.
whereas Seven Wonders, you added, you know, an extra 6 minutes, and most of that is just making sure you got all the cards in the deck.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely agree with you there. What was the last war game that hit your table, either literal or a virtual tabletop type thing? What was the last thing you were playing?
Well, I think the last sort of pure historical war game I've been playing was The Shores of Tripoli, which I also tried for the first time at your convention at the ACDC. And I thought that was a really cool way to get into that. And so, yeah, I've been checking that out a bit since then. And that's a lot of fun, both solo and as a two-player game. But it's sort of a war game, but not entirely, because it's about the future and it's not about a past war. But I've been playing Stellar Horizons with a group of my friends remotely over Vassal. And that's been a lot of fun. It's space exploration, eventual conquest. There isn't a whole lot of war at the start, but towards the end of the game, it seems like you can get into more of a military mode. So that's a bit cool one to explore.
Yeah, once you run out of space to claim, and you've got to start claiming other people's space.
Yeah,
sort of what you get to. Shores of Tripoli, I thought was a blast. I got a copy of it last fall. We reviewed it for the site. Game designer Jim Werbeneth was one of the first guys that I played that one with. He happened to be in town here, and so he and I got it out. He came by work one day, and we pulled it out and threw it on the counter there at work. So I was selling Powerade to soccer players alongside me and Jim playing.
Nice.
Playing Shores of Tripoli. And we had a good time. I'm still trying to figure out why Kevin's packed so many yellow dice in the game when at most you ever need two of them. And there's like 12. But, hey, who doesn't need extra dice?
For sure. Yeah, no, I think it's a very good game. I like the way he uses the cards. I particularly think a clever thing there is the ability to pull back your entire deck or whatever, but before the final crucial turn. So you don't run to that thing you sometimes get in some card driven games where like I need this pivotal event to do this thing, but it's never come up. And so yes. I think there's a very inventive approach there.
Yeah. Or you end up being forced to bury it. Otherwise, you'll lose the game very early on. But all that does is prolong the inevitable, because without that event later, you're going to have a really hard time winning.
For sure.
So, some bad luck of the draw just screws you on that. I've enjoyed it. And one of the things I really like about it is there was zero compromise on production value in that game. Mm-hmm. It is a gorgeous game to put on the table for people to take a look at. Yeah, not that it necessarily stops traffic, because it's not like there's a lot of traffic out there right now. But, you know, when you do have it on the table, it looks good and people look at it and go, wow, that what is that? That's kind of cool. And so I'm looking forward to having that on a table at a game convention at some point in the hopefully not too distant future.
For sure.
We'll see when we get there. All right. So by Stealth and Sea and Shores of Tripoli, both at the ACDC, was that it, or were there any others you jumped into?
I think those were the only two I got in that weekend. I did have to do a bunch of work that weekend. I also I sat in on a number of the seminars and podcasts and that. So it was a good convention. It was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. Glad you enjoyed it. And the mandatory infomercial plug, and I promise Andrew didn't set us up for this, but we do have the next one coming up in June. I think it actually is Father's Day weekend. That wasn't the intent. The intent was we took over the weekend that Origins vacated when they moved their live convention to October. Look, you were planning on playing war games that weekend anyway. You're just going to have to do it remotely with us instead of in person with us in Columbus. So we will have another one coming up in June, and hope to have a good time with everybody again. Folks seem to like this, and as long as people enjoy them, I guess we'll keep doing them. So
yeah, Absolutely, yeah, and I appreciate you guys taking the time to do a digital convention. I think a cool thing about the digital ones is that there's less. It's a lot easier to attend them in some cases because you don't have to drive anywhere, you don't have to get a hotel, and so on. So I mean, I've been to a few physical conventions over the years. I would go to KublaCon in the Bay Area every year. That's a thing. I went to GMT West once, but it's been nice getting to do some virtual ones like the ACDC and SD HISCon that I probably wouldn't have been able to do in person.
Yeah. One of these days I want to get out to SD HISCon just cause I want to go hang out with everybody.
Definitely. I've heard it's great in person. So yeah, that's on my radar to do someday as well.
Yeah, SD HISCon, I'm going to have to get on a plane. WBC is the other one that is on my bucket list, and I could actually drive to WBC. I'm close enough that I can get to that one. One of these days, I will actually be able to chisel the time free to go do that one. So the Dragoons, we do Origins every year as our anchor convention, and we've been doing this for a while. Even back before the Dragoons existed, we were doing that one. Largely because of the relationship that I already had with Gamma, and so I was able to sort of talk them into giving us some space to do the wargaming program there, and we've just sort of held on to it and kind of dared them to throw us out, which hasn't happened yet. So we're going to keep doing it. And it's been fun. People, we've gotten to the point now where people are coming back year after year, expecting us to be there and looking for us and
nice. You
know, intentionally trying to find the events we're doing and sort of put those in first and then figure out what else they're going to go do around that. And that's cool. That's rewarding that, you know, the people enjoyed what you had to offer, and that's totally on the GMs, right? Yeah, I'm the idiot who was dumb enough to volunteer for all the data entry stuff to get everything in the schedule, and I organize a lot of the logistics and take care of the badges and everything. But the guys like Jim and Mike and, you know, Doug and those guys, I say Jim, there's multiple Jims, the Jims plural, those are the guys that do all the heavy lifting. I said I'm just the bonehead who volunteered for all the data entry jobs. So.
For sure. Well, and I think it's really good that you guys do that at Origins. I mean, I think there's tremendous opportunity, really, to get broader swaths of the modern board game hobby interested in board games. A lot of the people I play Euros with, when some war games or war-ish games I've tried to introduce to them, have gone over quite well. And I think there are more people like that who are interested in some of the mechanics here in particular. I mean, if you look at the success of Root in particular, which really has a lot of coin themes going on in it, I think there's a great opportunity to try and get some of these games to a broader audience, and a presence at a convention like Origins definitely should help with that.
Yeah, there are some games we found, there are some things that naturally draw people in, that they walk by and they look at the table and go, oh, that looks pretty cool. What is that? And when we had the Sergeant's Minis game from Lost Battalion, that one always stopped traffic. That one,
sure.
Because it's all pre-painted individual figs with the little nameplate on the back of the figure, and you've got separate cards for each one of these dudes. And so it's your squad against my squad. And if we need a third squad, we bring somebody else into the game, and it's fine. It scales pretty well for multiplayer stuff. And while it is a geomorphic sort of puzzle board set of tiles that put all of the terrain together, there are some constructible tiles so you can put a building out there in the middle. It looks like a building. It's not just, you know, an overlay on the map. And so people walk by and like, oh, that looks kind of cool. And that draws people in more than, you know, hex and counter stuff, just counters on a map. Because it's different. People look at that and go, oh, that looks kind of neat. Honestly, the 100% most show-stopping thing we'd ever done was when we did the 1826 Kriegspiel, when we did the legit double-blind Kriegspiel, because the guys that were running that for us brought with them the blinders. They brought the big pop-up folding sort of study carol desk pieces.
Right. Wow.
And so we blocked off all the tables so that everybody only has their map and their pieces to look at. And we've got the runners going back and forth. And so you're walking through the exhibit hall and it looks like these guys are taking the SATs. And you're like, what the hell?
Yeah.
And we had a lot of people stop to ask what was going on. And Wednesday night, we did a free one just because we said, look, we're going to stop and start at any moment. Just we're trying to make sure that the runners and the GMs all fully understand how this is supposed to work, that that we've got the scenario locked down. So we may start and stop and change things at any moment, not necessarily carry through. That's what you get for playing for free.
Yeah.
And we're like, okay, fine, sure, whatever. And so we had, you know, 10, 12 volunteers sort of sitting around, you know, being a part of this, just sort of drop in, drop out as they could. We had a bunch of folks walking by going, what the hell is that? And a few of them were able to sit in that night. A bunch of them came back on Thursday when we were Thursday or Friday, whenever we actually did the event for real. And generally for events like that, where you kind of need an even number, like if we're going to do six players, that means we need six players and six runners. So we need 12 total participants. I think we had set that at 16, eight players, eight runners. And we had generally crafted the scenario where they could like trade places halfway through, so everybody got a chance to be a player and a runner. And if we don't get enough participants, ticketed participants, we'll throw a couple of our staff in there just to round out the numbers. Just keep the numbers even. Let's not mess up the game by not having enough. We started out having to kick staff people out of the game because had folks showing up. That was cool. But then we had a handful of folks show up with generic tokens trying to get in the game, except we were maxed out at that point between ticketed players and people that already got there first with generics. We were maxed out. And we try to make it a point to not ever turn people away. You mentioned Liberty or Death. A couple of years ago, we did Liberty or Death as the coin game that we were showcasing that year. It was the year it was released. And so we had two tables going. So we had eight players, and that was the max that we had on the event. But we had a bunch of other guys show up with some generics hoping to get in the game. I ended up getting out my personal copy, and we set up a third table.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
We had to. We had enough people show up to do it. And, so that was kind of neat. So we don't want to turn people away, but unfortunately, those Kriegspiels, we had to. But I mean, folks stopped. They're like, what the hell? Are they taking the SATs in here? What's going on?
Right.
So Kublai Khan, what were some of your experiences there? I know some of the dudes that help run Kublai Khan, so I'm curious.
Yeah, it's I always really like it. I've been in the Bay Area for the last few years, and then I was in the Central Valley before that. So I usually go with the same group of guys from the Central Valley every year, and we just have a blast. We hang out and play games all day, every day. There are some cool, they do have some cool designer events. They do have some cool panels and so on. But it's also just, it's a great location in that it's all set up just in this giant atrium, really, of this one hotel. And so there's lots of space, lots of air, lots of ventilation and so on. And you just, it's a great place to just go and play games for a weekend.
Yeah. And let's all hope we get a chance to do that again here before too long.
Absolutely, yeah.
You mentioned some designer events. Out of curiosity, have you ever gotten a hankering to try and design your own game, and what'd you come up with?
Ooh, yeah. I've played around a little bit, mostly with a couple of train game designs. One real short card, multi-use card one, and then I'm working on an 18XX title at the moment. But I don't know if either of them's ever going to get to a point where it's publishable or so. The biggest thing that I find from trying to tinker with and design games is it gives you a real appreciation for the people who do design games more regularly. It's a lot of work to really get something from ideas to a playable game.
Yeah. No, that is definitely true. It is not easy to do, and it can be very frustrating. And the people that do it well have my undying admiration. Not just for giving me cool stuff to play with, but because I can understand how hard that stuff can be. And
yeah, have you designed anything yourself?
A couple of bad ones. So many years ago, this is 15, 18 years ago at this point. So I had Bayonet Games going for a while that was barely more than a vanity press. I was essentially a glorified self-publisher.
Cool.
And so I had some RPG stuff and some tabletop stuff. Some of the RPG stuff got some decent reviews on RPG.net. This was many moons ago. got way more media coverage than I ever got sales, which I always thought was kind of funny.
Right.
It was an interview with me in Game Informer magazine for a book that I sold like six copies of. I still got a whole bunch of them in the box. Like I've been moving. This is like the sixth different move that I've made with these, you know, with these games in a box. And it was a source book for a fantasy game. So it was sort of a description of a small continent that you could use as a scenario setting area.
Sure.
And then 05, 06, 07, I had the Warfighter series. This was not DVG's Warfighter series. I had a Warfighter series long before he did.
Fair enough. Didn't know that. Yeah.
But it was modern platoon level combat, so sort of Panzerblitz for the modern age. But I tried to bring into it some of the things that I had experienced when I was in the military. Mm-hmm. And so, like, recon units actually have a recon job in the game.
Sure, for instance.
Radio nets actually matter. You know, who's talking to who on which radio net does matter in the way the game is structured.
Cool.
So there were some things that I tried to put in there. It was like every other self-published anything out there. It was horribly underdeveloped. I grossly underestimated how much development work is needed to make those things viable. And one day they may get dusted off and reincarnated. We'll have to see. It would take somebody much better at development than me to make that happen. So yeah, that's on the hobby side. I've done a couple of things for DoD folks over the years, not as a solo endeavor, but as a part of a team. I've done some different stuff. Regular podcast listeners can probably recite it all just because I've talked about it a handful of different times. I did the Gemstone Project for NDU, and then I did some stuff with the NSA years and years ago. It was fun. It was a chance to do something kind of cool and kind of meaningful and see a different side of wargaming, which was the big important part of it all for me. It was a good learning experience. It was fun. But as you've said, it gives you a really good appreciation for how hard it is and how tough those games, which is why I can't figure out how Brian Train like cranks out games like crazy and all with different mechanics doing different things in different ways. It's like, do you sleep? Like, so,
and in between that, he goes around inventing Pantzookas, right?
Yes. He goes around inventing Pantzookas.
That was a great conversation you had with him during the ACDC on that.
Oh, yeah. I remember Gary joking about we have now entered the most Canadian talk show ever. but yeah, Dan, I thought Dan was going to turn inside out from how hard he was laughing at the whole Pantzooka story. That was a scream. I had met Brian years before on some sort of correspondence that we'd had along the way, and I talked him into coming to Connections in 2011 when it was at NDU. And he had been to Connections a couple of years before when it was co-hosted with like Game Tech or ITSEC or one of the other big industry conventions. Mm-hmm. And Connections kind of got swallowed by the other convention. He really didn't have a great time. And I really had to kind of do a sell job to get him to show up to Connections in 2011. And at the end of it all, he came back to me. He's like, dude, this was the best time I'd had at a convention in forever. I was like,
Thank you.
Because I'd have really felt bad.
If
you travel all the way out here from the West Coast of Canada to tell me that, you know, you had a crappy time, I'd have really felt bad about it. So I'm just not that it had to be the best one ever, just that it was good. So it was kind of fun. I ended up, Brian and Rex Brynan and I all stayed at the same hotel, but because they both flew in and I drove in, I had the car. So I ended up playing taxi for the Canadians all weekend.
right.
Which is fine. It didn't bother me. Drive some Canadians around. How does a Canadian end up as interested in the American Civil War as you are?
Oh, well, yeah, that's a good question. I think it started with, my dad is also a history major and then also went into journalism from that. But so he always had a lot of history books lying around the house. And I think, one of the first ones I read when I was about 7 or 8 or something was he had this old book called Heroes in Blue and Gray, and it was just a story of 10 different generals from the American Civil War and some of their most pivotal battles and so on. And I must have read that thing like 10, 15 times or so, because it was a very interesting look at these personalities and also at these battles and at battles with a lot of very interesting strategic choices, such as Chancellorsville and the flanking movement and so on, and or Chickamauga and how George Thomas held on there. And so that spawned a bigger interest for me. I started reading historical fiction about the Civil War, such as Bernard Cornwell's books. I read a lot of actual history about it. And even when I went to university and did a history degree in Canada, a lot of the stuff I took was American history, not just the Civil War, but also just 19th century in general. And there's a lot of really, really interesting, fascinating characters in that period and fascinating things that happened, but they don't get talked about as much necessarily in outside of those circles as like World War II and other parts of the 20th century do. So yeah, the American Civil War has always been interesting to me from that standpoint. It's also been interesting to me from a pure military standpoint for things discovered there that would go on to be important later, like the importance of really of trenches and fortified positions and how hard it is to attack that, which I think a lot of people in World War I should have paid better attention to. And yeah. So, and the importance of artillery, the importance of various reconnaissance, whether that's with cavalry or with the various things they tried, like balloons and so on. You get the first ironclad ships, and the naval side of it's really really interesting, really fascinating. In fact, actually, one of my favorite war games on that front. There's a couple of really good ones, but I like Iron and Oak a whole lot, which is sort of it's a GMT game, and it's has a bunch of scenarios for Civil War naval combat, and so that's very cool. But yeah, it's a war that I think has a lot of fascinating dimensions. It's a war that, no matter what kind of battle you're interested in or what kind of tactic or strategy you're interested in, you could probably find something along those lines in the Civil War, given how vast it was and how wildly different the different theaters were.
Yeah, one of the neat things about it, there's also the blockade running side of mm-hmm. things, where you've got Absolutely. The game on the Confederate blockade. I know for sure there were two at one point. I don't know if they ever, you know, got a third or a fourth or fifth published. The fact that there are two means that David Thompson won't be doing one.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's already way too overexposed for him. I think you're generally right that whatever it is you're interested in, you can probably find something in the American Civil War to help scratch that itch. I find it interesting that you're the fourth or fifth non-American that I've met over the years that has a deep interest in the American Civil War. And quite sure. frankly, I have none. Like, I just,
yeah, sure.
of all of the eras of warfare to play, that mm-hmm. is probably my least favorite. And I don't really know why. I can sort of articulate why I don't like Catan. I'm just mm-hmm. not really sure why I'm not a big Civil War dude. I don't mind Napoleonics, and they're very similar mm-hmm. era. You know, obviously there's differences along the way, but I just the Civil War stuff never really struck me as really, you know, oh my God, I gotta play this.
Sure.
Yeah, I've played A House Divided long ago. I enjoyed it. It was a fun game. What I liked about it is it gave you a big wide scope, but you could finish it in an afternoon, so that was cool.
Sure. Yeah.
But I know there's a great and deep love for both the Great Battles and the Great Campaigns series out there, and tons mm-hmm. of fans of them. And it's just, I'd rather go play ASL.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. Yeah, and I think in some ways you have an interesting point there. I think maybe there's more of an appeal to it for some of us who didn't grow up with it, right? Who didn't grow up hearing the American Civil War talked about in school a whole lot. And so, like, for me, part of the interest came from sort of discovering it on my own. It was never anything I did for high school history or whatever. It was what I would look yeah. into for fun. And so there's an advantage to that if you're not from the U.S.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, for you, if it's something you decide, yeah, this isn't for me, you can just drop it and walk away. And that
right, exactly. Yeah.
there's nothing lost. So yeah, I can totally see that. You know, again, just sort of curious, you know, what it was that made you go, hey, that's what I want to. I think with your simultaneous interest in like some of the train games. You know, maybe it's just that 19th century period feel that.
That's true too. Yes, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I think that was also part of it. I've long had an interest in trains and railways, and part of what appeals to me about some of the more strategic level Civil War stuff, such as For the People, and the other one I meant to mention on the naval front is Rebel Raiders on the High Seas, which is a very good strategic level look at that, but also has some land aspect and some trades. But I always found it really interesting how integral the railroads were, especially for the Union, in moving troops around from one theater to another and getting places way faster than they would have thought they could. And so I'm sure that played into my interest in that period as well.
Yeah. The railway thing I could see, and seeing there be kind of that natural sort of 19th century period interest tie in there. And maybe it's just a lack of interest in the 19th century because, not unlike the ACW train games, you know, I've played a few and they just haven't done it for me all that much. Sure. And maybe I just haven't played any of the good ones, but I've not been bitten by the train game bug thus far. So, you know, it's funny, years ago, I would have, you know, stood on a table for how can you not like the same things that I like? Right. Clearly, right. You're uneducated Rube and don't see all the magnificence that is the things that I like. And, you know, these days I'm just kind of like, man, play what you like. Like, at least you're playing something. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think one thing that's really nice about the gaming hobby in 2021 is that there's something out there for everyone, right? Like, and there are so many good war games on whatever time period you're interested in. There's so many good train games on whatever thing you're interested in. There's a zillion Euro games out there. So I think it's definitely cool that no matter what you're into, you can probably find something.
Yeah. And I think that's definitely something that was not true as I was growing up. I played a lot of war games because my dad was a war gamer and kind of, you know, dad was my hero, wanted to be cool like dad. And so I played a lot of war games kind of with him growing up, and, you know, going back to like 6 and 7 years old, had no idea what I was doing, but he'd let me sit on his lap and push some counters around. He'd tell me where to push them. And so I'm playing games with dad. This is cool. Later, like every other, you know, nerdy, geeky, overly intelligent, under-challenged kid in elementary school, I found D&D and played the hell out of role-playing stuff for, you know, my whole life.
Sure.
And there weren't a ton of other options out there at the time. And you were either a role-playing guy or you were a war gamer, because that middle ground didn't really exist that we know of as kind of the Euro game stuff today. If you weren't playing war games, you were playing Monopoly.
Right.
And what's interesting is you go back and look at the Avalon Hill catalog from a long time ago, when they had a lot of stuff that was not wargaming. Lie, Cheat, and Steal, you know, the game about politics, was kind of a fun, goofy little game. Nobody looks back with fond memories at Lie, Cheat, and Steal the way they look back and go, oh man, Carcassonne's really stood the test of time.
Right.
I don't know that Lie, Cheat, and Steal was a bad game. I just think it's, you know, tarnished by having been an Avalon Hill game. And so nobody wants to touch it. Oh, that's war game adjacent. Therefore, we must shun it or something.
Yeah, that's interesting, though, because, I mean, there certainly have been some Avalon Hill themes that have stood the test of time that aren't specifically war games, right? Like a choir was them for a long time. It is still played by a lot of Euro gamers. 1830 on the train game side, it started as an Avalon Hill publication, and then you even get into, I mean, they I think you're right that there absolutely are some people who are like, oh, I would never touch them, they only do war games. But I think they did a lot of very interesting stuff over the years that they don't always get credit for. I mean, what I really like is the old Avalon Hill Civilization, right? And that's still a game that's a lot of fun. It has spawned a million imitators.
Yeah, it definitely has. And one of the first 4X type of games that I ever played, back when we used to, instead of 4X, we were calling them Realm Builders.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Dragon Magazine number 77 had King of the Tabletop, which was later re-implemented as Kings and Things as a standalone board game, which I'm not sure is any better than the old King of the Tabletop. But it was one of those Tom Wham games that you got two, three times a year tucked into Dragon Magazine. And King of the Tabletop was a blast. It's interesting how many of the ideas in King of the Tabletop ended up in other games years later, probably without even having been directly influenced by them. But the terrain in King of the Tabletop, you have swamps, plains, mountains, forests, you know, it's straight out of Magic the Gathering and you know, and different colors of characters that you can pull in based on the land that you control, which, you know, it's sort of straight up Magic the Gathering there. There are varying paths to victory. The first one to build a structure of a certain magnificence or conquer X number of other players or have X amount of gold in your treasury, which are shades of Tiny Epic Kingdoms or any number of other Realm Builder games. I'm not saying that everybody went back to King of the Tabletop and said, let's steal that idea, because half these people probably didn't know it existed. But the ideas were clearly there and they were really well done. And that was 35 years ago.
Right. Absolutely.
So the only bummer of it was because it was a Dragon Magazine, right? It's all cardstock. It's all nice and flimsy. You got to sort of cut it out and mount it on something to be durable. But yeah, back in sixth and seventh grades, man, we spent a lot of lunch times playing King of the Tabletop.
Nice.
Like that game you could win without kicking everybody's ass, which works well as a Euro style game where there's not always, you know, the path to victory is not always direct conflict. And so outside of some weird stuff like that in an occasional Dragon Magazine game, like you didn't have non-war game, non-role-playing game options.
Right.
Totally. And so it's good to fill that space. Mm-hmm. And it's good that there are nice, challenging strategy games out there that people can play that aren't necessarily, you know, high fidelity military war game sim type things. I can get my son to sit down and play Seven Wonders with me. He kicks my ass pretty regularly at Seven Wonders Duel. I can't get him to play. I can get him to play tank on tank. That's as much as I can get him to do for a war game. Anything more complex than that, he's just not interested. I would love to have him sit down and play more stuff with me, but I'm happy with what I get. So
for sure.
As we are recording this, we're coming up close to an hour. By the time I edit out me saying too many times, I'll probably chop 10 minutes off of this. But what else you want to cover? What else we want to talk? You want to talk about the magnificence that was the 98 Astros and how underrated an offensive team they were? Or do we want to keep going on some game stuff? What do you got?
I'm happy to talk about whatever. So the 98 Astros, hey, that's what made them appeal to you?
I've been an Astros fan since the early 80s. Nolan Ryan was my first favorite player, and he was a pitcher for the Astros at the time. And so I was just always an Astros fan. The 98 Astros are remembered for Randy Johnson coming in, you know, in the midseason trade and kicking ass. But you got to take a look at the numbers that the 98 Astros put up. They went like eight guys deep that were 300 hitters. That, like, the pitching staff hit 260 for the season or something. I mean, it was an incredible lineup top to bottom. And it was like, oh yeah, Enron Park, everybody. No, this was in the dome.
Right.
This was in the dome that they were mashing like that. And, you know, Biggio put up a 50 steals, 50 doubles season. You know, Bagwell was still healthy.
An incredible player. Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, then Biggio, as usual, didn't clean his helmet the entire season.
For sure.
But, yeah, that 98 Astros team gets forgotten because they got smoked by a Padres pitching staff that was pitching about 10,000 levels above their normal. And so, you know, it was, yet another early round failure for the Astros in the playoffs.
Right.
But they were, as an offensive team, that team was loaded, and people forget just how good those guys could hit. It was pretty incredible.
So. No, for sure. Yeah, I'm looking at the roster now, and Bagwell, Biggio, Derek Bell. There's a lot of good hitters in there. I always find it interesting that you mentioned how nobody remembers MLB because of the playoffs. And I think that that's my biggest complaint with sports a lot of the time is that we overlook a lot of really good teams, really good players, really good seasons because of a playoff, a small sample size playoff that didn't go the particular way, right? I think it gets really interesting when you start looking at individual players. It's like, oh, well, whoa, they weren't that good. They didn't win any titles. It's like, well, look at who else was on their team for half their career.
No, absolutely. That 98 Astros team played incredibly well, won 100-something games, happened to run into a Padres team that, you know, Sterling Hitchcock and Kevin Brown just pitched incredible in the first two rounds. They ran out of gas against an all-time Yankees squad in the World Series. But I've always sort of stood on a table for these guys are underrated and everybody should know just how good they were. I mean, they were bringing a couple of 300 hitters off the bench, you know, between Sean Berry and Richard Hidalgo. And those guys each got several hundred plate appearances each. It's not like they hit 300
right.
A 12-game cameo in September or something. I mean, it's, you know, these guys could play and they were really damn good. And everybody remembers Randy Johnson showing up and going 10-1.
Right.
But they forget just how good the offense was that they had hitting for them. So it's always been sort of a pet cause of mine to make sure that the 98 Astros get their due as an underrated team.
For sure. Well, so. It's a good cause. You've raised my awareness of them, certainly, by a fair bit.
Well, I do what I can. So on the sports writing front, what is a particularly interesting story that you covered that you didn't think was going to be going into it? What's something that you're like, oh man, I got to go do this. And then it turned out, wow, this was kind of cool.
That's a good question. I like that one. Well, I think, so what I did for a long time, almost a decade, I covered the CFL for Yahoo Sports Canada, and a lot of CFL stories work that way. And especially at the Grey Cup, the big championship every year. And one thing that's cool about the Grey Cup is that compared to a lot of the big U.S. sports leagues, the CFL media still get way more access to individual players and not always in a big formal setting. And so you'll have you'll have breakfast with one team, lunch with another, and you'll eat with guys on the team and just chat while you're doing that, and you can wander around and talk to whoever you want and so on. And so there have definitely been a couple of great things that came out of that. One in particular stands out, and I've just got to find the guy's name. One second. Oh, yes, it was Eddie Johnson, I believe, and he was a punter for the Saskatchewan Roughriders in, this must have been 2010. But anyway, I wound up writing a piece about him that played off, of course, the Dos Equis ads at the time, that he was I titled it The Most Interesting Punter in the World. Yep. And the reason for this was, so... and this really stands out as what you were asking about something you didn't know would be all that great and wound up being that great. So I just wound up talking to this guy, Eddie Johnson, reading some other things on him before that. And anyway, he played college football. He was born in Newport Beach, California, played college football at Idaho State, of all places. Had some cups of coffee. yeah, absolutely. Going from Newport Beach to Idaho State. But anyway, bounced around the NFL, had some cups of coffee there and so on. And then went to the CFL and just sort of didn't really stand out his first year in 2009. But he got caught by Toronto. He goes back to Laguna Beach and he works at a sushi bar and a nightclub in the evenings, and during the day just hangs out on the beach and plays volleyball. And then midway through the 2010 season, the Saskatchewan Roughriders need a punter. And so they call in this guy who's just being the beach bum in California, and he winds up being a big star for them. So he described it as kind of the Corona commercial mixed with the Bud Light commercial, mixed with the Keystone commercial, mixed with the Dos Equis commercial. It's a conglomeration of all of that.
Yeah. And, the punter is a bigger deal in the CFL also because you have the rouge. Like you can actually score punts with a point. So I think that's should not be underestimated.
I've always enjoyed talking to punters and kickers. Punters and kickers are often fascinate people because they're members of the team and they do an important job, but their job is so different from just about everyone else, right? And so a lot of them often have some pretty interesting things to say.
My junior year of high school, the kicker on the team was also on the soccer team, as many high school kickers are. They are also on the soccer team. Except John was slightly nuts, and he was not one of those dudes that was gonna be sort of the safety valve behind everything. Like, he'd kick off and he'd go flying down the field to go make a tackle also.
Oh, nice.
And not that he made a lot of them, but he made enough of them that, you know, it was noteworthy. And there were a couple of games we were in that were some pretty horrendous blowouts here and there that he talked the coach into letting him go play linebacker.
You know? Oh, nice.
So you had the kicker out there making tackles as
playing
a linebacker.
That's great.
That high school team, so my junior year, we had a couple of dudes that were seniors on that team. The reason we were in enough blowouts that John got a chance to play linebacker on occasion, we had future Kansas City Chiefs Hall of Famer Will Shields was on that team.
Nice.
Future Super Bowl champ James Trapp was on that team. Duell Brewer, who owned a lot of Oklahoma high school rushing records, was on that team. Duell Brewer ended up with the Colts and Bears for a while. And Mike Minter, future Carolina Panthers player and now coach locally here at Elon. I think he's at Elon. Maybe he's at Campbell. He's a college football coach right here in the area near me. He was a freshman on that team, so didn't see a lot of playing time.
Right.
So it was a fairly stacked roster that we were in a bunch of blowout games.
Sure.
That they got a chance to do goofy things like let the kicker play linebacker. And then they ended up losing to the eventual state champ, which was Cale Gundy's team, Mike Gundy's little brother. Cale Gundy, who ended up as a coach at Oklahoma for a while. He quarterbacked at OU and was a coach there for a while. But Cale Gundy's high school team won the state title that year. So it's not like we lost to a bunch of schlubs.
No, you know? No, absolutely. Yeah.
But that was a fair look. My senior year, the football team stunk. They were, I'm not sure we were a 500 team that year. We were pretty bad, but that year was a pretty fun year watching those guys, you know, blow through folks. So
very cool.
It's always fun when you get to watch blowouts on your side.
So. Absolutely. Yeah.
But yeah, kickers and punters are weird. And John was one of those weird ones. So well, that's interesting that you got a chance to sort of hang out with the punter there and get a good story out of it.
Yeah, definitely. No, and I do really like that question. I think that a lot of good things I've done over the years have been whatever interview or whatever didn't look all that great at first, and then somebody winds up giving you a great quote or giving you a new perspective. So it's a good way to approach.
One of the things that I've found a little challenging sometimes out of running a site like us, that is, let's face it, it's very loosely journalism adjacent compared to the kinds of things you do in your day job. And I'm not going to – look, I got a master's in journalism. I'm not going to pretend that what we do is high art kind of journalism or anything. But, you know, we try to maintain some appropriate standards in the things that we publish and the things that we put our name on. But one of the challenges that I've always found is, you know, we've got a crew of volunteer writers. Nobody's getting paid squat for the stuff we do. We occasionally get some review copies of things sent to us, so we're getting some free swag out of it. But, you know, the writers are doing this because they enjoy doing it. And so it's really tough for me to, like, give somebody an assignment, like as the editor at the site, for me to say, hey, go do this. Sometimes guys will ask, hey, what do you think about this? They'll give me two or three things. I got these couple of things. What do you want me to do first? And so we'll talk about some of those things. But I'm not really in a position where I can say, hey, you go do that one. And I've never really been in a position like that for me where I've been getting assigned to something back when I was a writer. Hey, Brant, go write this. It was always, hey, are you interested in something? And so we always had the option to say no. That kind of story that you get assigned, you get sort of air quotes, right, stuck with, that you find out turns out to be really cool. Like, that doesn't happen for us.
right, for sure.
Because if it sounds like a dud, people are just going to say no, and they're well within their rights to do so.
right, totally.
What is up next for you in the gaming world? You mentioned you've got your Stellar Horizons game still going on.
Yeah.
I'm expecting that's probably continuing beyond when this podcast is going to happen, but What else is
probably
on the docket?
Probably, yeah. That's a giant campaign. So yeah, that's going to be going for a while. Yeah, I play a lot of 18XX, usually a couple of times a week for a live game with some friends, and then some async of that. And yeah, in terms of war games, I don't know if I have anything planned right now, but there's definitely a few that I'm always looking to play. I always see if I can carve up some time for some solo coin or coin with other people if I can talk them into it. I do really like a lot of the ones that are sort of wargaming and Eurogame crossovers. Like a couple that stand out there for me are A Few Acres of Snow and Hands in the Sea, and I can sometimes get, because they're deck building war games, I can sometimes get my Eurogamer buddies to play those with me. And yeah, beyond that, there's a lot of stuff I enjoy soloing. I've been enjoying checking out the solo for Tank Duel recently. That's a good one. And
I didn't know that had a solo option to it.
It does. Yeah, they've built in a pretty good solo system based on the card pulls and that, and that works pretty well. But yeah, that's a fun game. I'm having fun exploring that and hoping to do that more. And again, not entirely past war or anything, but a GMT one I do really like is the Space Empires 4X series. That's one I always enjoy soloing, and have managed to talk one friend of mine into play that a bit here and there. I think that's a really cool 4X game.
I've got some friends that absolutely swear by that and love it to mm-hmm. death. I have Space Corp here the shelf that I want to get to mm-hmm. at some point. And Michael Eckenfels, one of our writers, did a long Space Corp AAR playthrough.
Nice.
Not long after we opened the Dragoons. It ran 20-odd episodes. I mean, he took his time and got really in-depth explaining what was happening each turn and really mm-hmm. into the weeds in detailing what was going on. And it was a really neat read through, and on the strength of that, I got a copy of it and still haven't had a chance to get to the table yet.
For sure.
As we are recording this, I still have the White Tribe on my table. I've got to finish that one up. I've got about three turns left, and I've been writing that one up for the site also. So I've got about three turns left on that one. I need to finish that up and be done with it, and then move on to whatever is next, whether it's Space Corp or something else. I've got a backlog of a half dozen things I want to play.
Sure.
Unfortunately, not all of them are solo very easily. And so mm-hmm. I've got to figure out some way around this until the plague finally subsides. So
for sure.
Hoping that is soon. Well, we've covered a lot of ground tonight, and I do appreciate you taking some time out of your busy evening there and the flexibility in scheduling so that we were able to get you in this season before we got too far along, because I know you had some other plans we had to work around. So thank you for the flexibility and all that.
No, thank you for the flexibility on your end. It's great to talk with you, Brant, and I've really enjoyed this.
It's always enjoyable to find somebody who's willing to talk sports and music and games, and that is just awesome. And it doesn't happen nearly enough, because most of the Dragoons have good taste in only one of those three areas. So to find somebody who's batting better than 300 is kind of nice. I kid. The Dragoons like to give me a hard time about my taste in music, and they're wrong, of course. But I
for sure,
I suffer the humor as I should. So, but thanks. This was great. This was a lot of fun. Hope to have you back sometime in the future. Maybe in next season we come back and talk something a little more specific instead of just a lot of generalities. But more importantly, I hope you're able to make the summer ACDC. I hope you're able to join us for some gaming again in June.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to do my best to try. I had a lot of fun with the last one. So
hope they're not sending you off to cover punters again.
Hopefully not. No.
Whatever it may be. Cool. Well, Andrew, thank you very much. Audience, thank you very much. We really appreciate you guys joining us here on Mention and Dispatches. We'll have another couple of episodes before we wind down this season as we head into the summer. Even though the summer is not convention season as we normally envision it, we are still taking our summer hiatus just so we don't burn out the guest roster as we crank through these weekly podcasts. So thank you very much for being here. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us. And we will talk to everybody next time on another episode of Mention and Dispatches.